Today is Thursday, March 8th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, British police say a nerve agent was used to poison a Russian spy. The U.S. Justice Department sues California over immigration enforcement.
This will end up in the Supreme Court. There's almost no question.
Another drama rocks the White House.
The events not only relating to her relationship with the president, but also the conduct and what she's witnessed over the last 12 to 18 months as it relates to efforts to silence her.
Also ahead on International Women's Day, has the past year seen progress? It's all on today's International Edition. Well, Britain is threatening a robust response if it's proven that Russia is behind the apparent attempted poisoning of a former Russian double agent. Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia were captured on security cameras not long before they were found collapsed on a bench in their hometown of Salisbury in southern England Sunday, showing symptoms of poisoning. Both remained in critical condition while investigators tried to determine what caused the severe sickness. David Doyle has details.
British police confirmed Wednesday that former Russian spy Sergei Skripal was poisoned.
This is being treated as a major incident involving attempted murder by administration of a nerve agent.
Skripal's daughter Yulia was also apparently deliberately targeted. The former colonel in Russia's intelligence service and his daughter are still critically ill in intensive care. Both were found unconscious on a bench on Sunday outside a shopping centre in the southern city of Salisbury. Skripal was accused in the past by Moscow of betraying dozens of spies to British intelligence and jailed before being later released in a spy swap involving the US. The UK's head of counter-terrorism is now leading the investigation to find those responsible.
I've been very clear, we've identified a nerve agent, that's helping our investigation, but I'm not going to give any further detail at this stage.
He did, however, confirm that one of the first police officers at the crime scene on Sunday is also now seriously ill. The incidents already prompted a war of words between Russia and the UK.
That should evidence emerge.
Britain's Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson talking up a robust response if Moscow is found to be behind the poisoning. Russia has hit out at the speculation in the UK press and called Johnson's remarks wild. A source close to the investigation has told Reuters that Russian involvement is just one of the scenarios being examined.
Russia has denied involvement and says it's willing to cooperate in the investigation. The International Monetary Fund and European leaders pushed back Wednesday against President Donald Trump's plan to impose steep tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, saying it would provoke a calamitous global trade war. European Council President Donald Tusk rebutted Trump's contention about trade wars.
President Trump has recently said, and I quote, "Trade wars are good and easy to win." But the truth is quite the opposite.
The European Union or Commission detailed retaliatory tariffs if it plans to impose on prominent U.S. products if Trump carries out his plan, saying they'll tax Harley-Davidson motorcycles, bourbon, blue jeans, cranberries, orange juice, and peanut butter. But despite the criticism, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said Trump is on track to make the formal announcement on the tariffs by the end of the week.
The president's been very clear that he wants to address the trade imbalance that the United States has with a number of countries. He feels like the United States has been taken advantage of for far too long, and he's not going to allow that to continue under his watch.
Moody's Investors Service said the planned tariffs raise the risk of a deterioration in global trade relations. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A teen accused of the Florida shooting in the school shooting indicted on 17 murder counts. Secretary of State Tillerson stops in Ethiopia on his first official visit to Africa. U.S. Holocaust Museum is rescinding the Human Rights Award to Myanmar's leader. And President Trump asks Beijing for a plan to slash U.S.-China trade imbalance. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, a porn star has filed a lawsuit seeking to invalidate a non-disclosure agreement that she signed days before the 2016 presidential election, which prevented her from discussing alleged sexual encounters with Donald Trump, where she was also paid $130,000. The lawsuit filed in Los Angeles alleges that the agreement is null and void and of no consequence because Trump didn't personally sign it. Adult film actress Stormy Daniels, whose real name is Stephanie Clifford, alleges that she began an intimate relationship with Trump in 2006 and that it continued well into the year 2007, according to the lawsuit. She said the relationship included encounters in Lake Tahoe, Nevada, and Beverly Hills, California. Her attorney, Michael Avenatti, told NBC why Clifford is filing the suit.
My client wants an opportunity to tell her story, to tell the truth about what happened and what didn't happen, to tell the truth about the events not only relating to her relationship with the president, but also the conduct and what she's witnessed over the last 12 to 18 months as it relates to efforts to silence her. She wants an opportunity to set the record straight.
Well, Trump married his current wife, Melania Trump, in 2005. Joining us now to talk more about the legal ramifications of someone suing a president is Los Angeles-based attorney Angela Reddock Wright of the Reddock Law Group. So does she have a case?
You know, she's saying that it's based on the fact that Trump did not sign the agreement. And while that is a factor, I don't think it's the most important factor because from what I understand, his attorney did sign. And most settlement agreements will have a place for the client or the party to sign and then also for their attorney to sign. And when the attorney signs, the attorney is affirming that they've shared the agreement with their client, that their client understands the terms of the agreement, or at least that they've explained the terms and that they agree to the agreement and the exact quote is in form and content. So the fact that his attorney signed and also paid the settlement definitely suggests that, for all intents and purposes, Trump agreed to the agreement. In addition to that, what would be equally important is whether she had her own counsel in the negotiation of the agreement, if her counsel explained to her the the contract, and that she had ample opportunity to review it and to consider it. And if those factors are also there, it's highly unlikely that she would be able to overturn the non-disclosure clause, because the ultimate point of these agreements is that you can guarantee confidentiality in non-disclosure. That's part of the consideration for the alleged misconduct. So a court overturning that piece of it would be a real message in the legal industry, or a court would be possibly turning over years of ways of doing settlement agreements and the practice around settlement agreements and the reason for settlement agreements and the inclusion of the non-disclosure clause. So I would have to think that a court would have a lot of thought around whether to actually overturn something like that that is considered a standard part of an agreement.
What about the fact that she alleges that the president used an alias in this agreement?
It's understandable that he used an alias just because he's Donald Trump. So I imagine that many agreements that involve celebrities or well-known individuals have aliases. Again, I think the real factors are, one, that he had an attorney that negotiated for him, and presumably in signing off on that agreement, his attorney also was signing off that his client was aware of the agreement, understood its terms, and that she also had an attorney that explained the terms to her. And if those factors are there, I think it's going to be very difficult for her to overturn the agreement.
Is it likely that an attorney paid someone off without his client knowing?
It's possible, and of course that would raise all sorts of other issues in terms of ethics and professional responsibility. But I would like to think, as a fellow lawyer, an attorney would not engage in such misconduct.
Is there a Supreme Court precedent that says a president cannot escape answering a lawsuit just because he's president?
Right. Well, we saw this in the Paula Jones case against Bill Clinton, and she was successful in arguing that although the president, he still had to testify and participate in the civil lawsuit that she brought against him. Mm-hmm. So I think that would be the standard here, that while Donald Trump and his attorneys may make it very difficult for Donald to have to engage in the lawsuit, whether it be through deposition or other discovery or other proceedings, there is that precedent that would make it difficult for him to escape participation in the lawsuit altogether.
All right. That's attorney Angela Reddock Wright of the Reddock Law Group. Thanks for being with us. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions vowing on Wednesday to stop California's resistance to a federal crackdown on immigration enforcement a day after the U.S. Justice Department filed a lawsuit against the state over its immigrant-related policies. The move is the latest friction between the federal government and the Democrat-governed West Coast state, which has repeatedly attempted to defy the Republican Trump administration and provide a legal buffer between increased enforcement and California's undocumented population, the largest in the nation. Joining us now to talk more about this, San Francisco-based attorney with the California Appellate Law Group, Ben Foyer. What exactly is at the heart of this lawsuit?
Well, the federal government is attacking three California laws that relate to its enforcement efforts with regard to illegal immigration and its efforts to locate illegal immigrants in California and deport them, which, of course, is something that President Trump ran on as a centerpiece of his campaign. So there are three different laws that the government is targeting, federal government is targeting, and the three different laws have very different constitutional and practical dimensions to them. The first law that the federal government is targeting is a law that California passed that gives California agents the right to inspect federal prisons that are holding illegal immigrants pending their deportation from California. There have been a number of news reports that some of these prisons have what some claim are inhumane conditions that are keeping children apart from their parents and the rest of their families, and are otherwise doing things that at least the people of California, represented by their elected representatives, find to be unacceptable. The second law that the federal government is targeting is a law that California passed that prevents California police officers from referring individuals that they have detained who they suspect may not be lawful immigrants, a law that prevents these police officers from referring them to immigration authorities, essentially from calling up INS and saying, or ICE, I guess it's called now, and saying, hey, I've got someone here. I'm not sure if they're a lawful immigrant. Why don't you come and take a look?
I know there are three separate issues that the Trump administration is going after within California regarding its immigration policies. And, you know, California is saying that the federal government has declared war on their policies. Obviously, this is a state versus federal issue or issues. Is there any precedent for any of this, and what do you think we'll see going forward here?
You know, this is one of the issues that comes up and has come up throughout American history. What are the different rights and authorities of the states versus the federal government in all kinds of areas of regulation? Here we're talking about immigration, and immigration is one of those unusual areas that's very state-focused. It very much goes on in cities and in towns in different states. But, of course, there's a big federal dimension. The borders are subject to federal control. So this is a real conflict between the state sovereignty and the federal government sovereignty. And it's a reversal in some ways of the usual way that state sovereignty comes out. Often you have Republicans and conservatives talking about state sovereignty against the federal government trying to come in and tell them what to do. And here you have a state, California, saying, hey, we're just regulating our own people and our own agencies, and now the federal government is trying to come in and tell us what to do. And so that's a little bit different than usual. There are some precedents involved. There was a case during the Obama administration where Texas and Arizona tried to have additional efforts at the state level to round up and deport illegal immigrants, and the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. That's up to the federal government. So you have this real conflict between state and federal sovereignty that's been going on really since the birth of the republic.
So where does this end up?
Well, this will end up in the Supreme Court. There's almost no question. The federal government has filed its lawsuit in part of California that's known for having some more conservative judges, but an appeal will go first to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals based in San Francisco. This is a court that has had a lot of contention with the Trump administration, has ruled against the Trump administration on its travel ban efforts and some other efforts also involving sanctuary cities. And then this will almost certainly go up to the U.S. Supreme Court after that.
All right. That's San Francisco-based attorney with the California Appellate Law Group, Ben Foyer. Thank you for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, today is International Women's Day, a global celebration in recognition of women's achievements with the Me Too movement and Time's Up, the Women's March. The past year has really seen a larger conversation emerge. The women's movement has been evolving and growing in strength across the United States. Women are actually changing the nation's political debate and inspiring record numbers of women to run for political office. Joining us now to talk more about this is Jennifer Lawless, professor of politics at American University. Thank you for being with us. So has the past year shown significant step forward for equality for women in your view?
So I think there were two steps forward, but also several steps back. There's no question that women's activism post Donald Trump's election reached epic levels. And so we've seen women sustain this level of activism too. It's not just that in January of 2017 they attended the Women's March, they remained politically active through the year, they participated in, you know, huge numbers for the second march, and they've also run for office or declared their candidacies in unprecedented numbers and have turned out to vote in important elections at rates that are certainly atypical. So on all of those indicators, there's certainly been improvement and growth. And the other major step forward, I think, has been calling attention to issues like sexual harassment in politics. And that was in part generated by responses to sexual harassment allegations in domains outside of politics, whether it be Hollywood or the media establishment or other industries. But we began to see real movement in state houses and even in Congress to ensure that there are policies and protocols in place for women who find themselves victims of sexual harassment. So all of that, I think, is very good and positive and suggests a trajectory that gets us to a place where women's societal status is elevated.
Do you think that it's a good idea to have an International Women's Day, or do you think it's like one of those things where you say, well, this is Breast Cancer Awareness Month and we only think about it this month as opposed to all year long and going forward?
I mean, I think it's important for a couple of reasons. The first is that it serves as a benchmark so that we can make comparisons, right? So if we want to see how far we've come in the last year, it's helpful to look back to a year ago or 2 years ago or 3 years ago on generally the same kind of date. So I don't think it offers an excuse for people not to focus on women for the other 364 days of the year. The other reason I think it's important is because it is international, and despite the attention that women in politics and women in other realms of society have garnered in the United States in the last year, that's not necessarily the case globally. And I think that matters too. Now, the steps back, I think, are also pretty damning for, you know, women's status in society and their progress in politics. We've seen Donald Trump double down on a lot of the sexism that characterized the campaign trail. We've seen now explicit denials, you know, of things like the Access Hollywood tape, where he, you know, it seems like there's no cost whatsoever to a president, not only for behaving this way to women, but then lying about it. And his approval rating, while low, is not much worse than when he got elected, right? So it's not like there's been this national outcry or that his behavior has turned off other groups of people.
What do you think about the theme this year, which is press for progress?
Look, this is a situation where, depending on how you measure progress, you're always going to be able to find it. But, you know, the way that I like to think about it is there a net positive effect?
And this year, probably, especially because of women's activism and the Democratic wave that's likely to characterize the 2018 midterms. You know, you can also imagine a scenario where if something happens and the Democrats fail to take back the House or, you know, don't even come close to flipping the Senate, we might have a completely different view about whether this actually did represent progress.
All right. Jennifer Lawless, professor of politics at American University. Now let's check in with VOA's Doug Johnson for what's trending on social media. What's the word, Doug?
Well, you know, the thing about social media is you just never know what's going to grab people's attention, what's going to be trending, what you may actually learn. For example, if I did not have social media, Facebook and Twitter, I probably wouldn't know that today is National Cereal Day. Like cereal, you know, you eat out of a bowl. Now, a lot of people are using the hashtag National Cereal Day. Don't ask me why. It seems a little strange, but, you know, sharing, oh, their favorite cereals from childhood and kind of goofing on some of the names. Well, it all seems very lighthearted, and I imagine will completely pass into the ether before the day is out. Also today, another hashtag, Alexa Laughing. Now, you may not be familiar. Alexa is that small Amazon-sold voice-driven personal assistant. You know, you can talk to it. It will help you. It will write your grocery lists and all these kinds of things. It employs a sort of AI back maintained by Amazon. And a number of people are using this hashtag, Alexa Laughing. And what they are saying is that the Alexa personal assistant is kind of acting up and then at random points just kind of laughing. And some people describe the laugh as really creepy. I actually tried it at home last night, and Alexa does laugh, and it is kind of creepy. Now, I don't know why she may be just sort of going off and freelancing, but it's got a number of people shook, and so they're talking about that.
All right, Doug, thanks so much. You can follow him on Twitter at @DFrontiers. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at @VOA_IE. Well, the band Imagine Dragons has a new single and a new album. International Edition's Sarah Williams talks about it with VOA's Border Crossings host, Larry London.
Today we're talking about one of my favorite bands in the last few years and also one of the most significant, prolific, and successful bands in the last few years, Imagine Dragons, who have a new album out. It's been out for about 10 months so far. It's called Evolve, and it is their third album, the follow-up to what was a moderate success, Smoke and Mirrors. The first album, Night Visions, about 5 years ago, gave them multiple Grammy nominations and Billboard Award nominations, and so they're back with a new album. This is the third single from the third album, so today we're going to listen to a song called Whatever It Takes from Imagine Dragons.
Why are they one of your favorite bands?
Well, I always like their style, their sound, their message, too. That's very important when a band has a message to it beyond just creating music. And this group definitely carries a message. They are from Las Vegas, where the terrible tragedy occurred last year, the casino shooting that took the lives of many, many people, 51, I believe, who were watching a country music show, innocently enough, and some random shooter out of a hotel window started to fire away. So Dan Reynolds, the lead singer, said on October 1st, we are going to remember that tragic day. We're going to stage a commemorative concert, a tribute to all of those who lost their lives. And so the band, being from Las Vegas, want to pay homage to what tragedy took place in their hometown. That's one of the things I like about the band, that they're very, very socially conscious. Dan Reynolds recently did an interview. He's the lead singer. He admitted that he deals with mental illness issues, that he's depressed, that he suffers from anxiety, bipolar disorder. He has all kinds of things going on. But they're very outspoken on a number of different issues. And he said he's getting tired of America in general. He said, there's just one tragedy after another going on in this country. Now, most recently, the school shooting in Florida. He said, when will this end? How many children have to lose their lives before our government does something about it? So Dan Reynolds is using his fame as a platform to speak out openly about his thoughts. He's also an advocate on behalf of gay rights, although he himself is not gay. He's married happily, and they have several children. His wife gave birth to two babies last year. But he said that that the LGBT community needs a voice, and he's happy to be one of those people who is a voice on behalf of that community. He said it's time, that was his words, it's time that we recognize that community, that part of America, that part of the world that deserves to be noticed. But the band Imagine Dragons have been doing this for a number of years. About a year ago or so, they even contemplated changing their names. To something else. They thought, Imagine Dragons, does that really say who we are? The guys in the band all said, Dan, yes, it does. We can't think of a better name. So he said, okay. And he went with it, and the name remains intact. All the guys in the band met at Berklee College of Music in Boston. They're all very talented musicians. And as I say, they have been successful with now what is their third album.
All right. Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossing. Whatever it takes.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Donald Trump and British Prime Minister Theresa May agreed that Russian President Vladimir Putin's recent statements on nuclear weapons development are irresponsible, according to a readout of President Trump's recent telephone call with the Prime Minister. In a recent speech to the two houses of parliament weeks prior to the Russian presidential election on March 18th, Mr. Putin claimed that Russia has and is on course to develop new additions to its nuclear arsenal, some of which he claims can defeat any missile defenses the U.S. or NATO can deploy. Mr. Putin accompanied his speech with a video animation showing a variety of weaponry, including nuclear-powered underwater vehicles, nuclear-powered cruise missiles, which he boasted had practically unlimited range, and a new heavy intercontinental ballistic missile equipped with a broad range of powerful nuclear warheads. One missile appeared to be targeted at the U.S. southern state of Florida. Department of State spokesperson Heather Nauert said the Kremlin's display of that kind of imagery is not the behavior of a responsible international player. She noted that with his speech and animation, Mr. Putin confirmed what the United States has known for a long time and which Russia has previously denied, that Russia has been developing destabilizing weapons systems for more than a decade. Ms. Nauert declared that President Trump understands the threats facing America and our allies in this century and is determined to protect our homeland and preserve peace through strength. U.S. defense capabilities are and will remain second to none, she added. We have a new defense budget that's over $700 billion. We believe that our military will be stronger than ever. The president's nuclear posture review addresses some of this. It made clear that we're moving forward to modernize our nuclear arsenal and ensure that our capabilities remain unmatched.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.